probably have noticed, the stock market hit an all-time record high today, over 22,000.
Sky's the limit. There's no reason for this market not to go higher. There's really no impediments. There's no headwinds.
The Dow is now up 20% since President Trump was elected.
The stock market hit the highest level that it has ever been, and our country is doing very well.
The president's completely right. These are good numbers. 209,000 non-farm payroll jobs, unemployment rate down to 4.3%, down to a 16-year low.
It's a great report. All those jobs, 16,000 in manufacturing. Heck, that's a year's worth for the Obama people, it seems.
We have a growth rate, a GDP, which has been much higher than, as you know, anybody anticipated, except maybe us.
Now, the president wants to be up at 3% GDP. We're really nowhere near a run rate of 3%.
He hasn't done anything on economic policy, so I don't know how you could take credit for the economy's performance. The economy's performing well, but it was performing well before the election.
If we're really going to drive the economy and drive economic growth and get from the muddling 2% to 3%, then we have to do something structural to the U.S. economy. We really have to change our tax rate.
You know, it doesn't get any better than that. It's a weekend in America. What a way to go home.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Well, it's another record-breaking week for the stock market, with the Dow Jones Industrial Average breaking a new record on this Friday, and the Dow crossing 22,000 for the first time this week. Other averages are up on the plus side, so it's been a good week overall for investors. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. In Hour 1, Ari Wald from Oppenheimer will be joining me. He says, look, we're heading into the fall, which we typically get a correction, but he doesn't expect much of one. He says this bull market is in full force, and you should be invested in pro-cyclical equities. He has four or five sectors he thinks will lead the next turnup as we melt up into the end of the year. He'll be joining me in Hour 1. Greg Weldon will also be joining me, and he has some surprising things to say about gold. It is a coiled spring ready to explode. You want to hear his reasons why. All of that coming up in Hour 1.
And I'm John Loeffler. You know, for the United States, things are looking good. The stock market is hitting records. The U.S. economy has picked up in the second quarter. It's growing at an annualized rate of about 2.6%. Unemployment, the lowest in decades, and wages are rising. Oil prices stable, gasoline low, and inflation is falling. Wow. I mean, this looks mucho terrifico, doesn't it? But the real question is, where are we as we come up upon the end of a business cycle? Because it looks like all of these things are short term. So what happens when things start to roll over, and what might make it sustainable, the good times, into the next year and keep things going for a little while longer? That'll be the major subject of the big picture. And along with this, you know, if this economy is as good as it gets for right now, when we reach the top of this bull market, what do tops look like? What is the internal structure of a top? And then if you're an investor, how do you navigate in that type of a market? All of that coming up on the big picture today in the Financial Sense News Hour. And first, as we always do every single week, we take a look at what happened in the markets this week. Chris Sheridan is filling in for Ryan Poplava, who is somewhat under the weather at this moment. And Chris is host of Financial Sense Insider, which airs during the week here at Financial Sense. So, Chris, I know you have a lot of stuff to talk about. Let's start with the bounce we saw in the dollar. It was really on Friday, and then we want to look at the jobs report, too.
Yeah, I would say that was the big thing that we saw this week, was the better than expected jobs numbers that came out on July payrolls data. They surprised to the upside with a print of 209,000. The estimate was 180,000, showing that the jobs market is still fairly healthy. And the reason that is important is because that, of course, still builds the case for further tightening by the Fed and a reduction of the Fed's balance sheet, showing that economic conditions are still positive. And some of the market moving effects that we saw come from that were a bounce in the dollar on Friday after the jobs numbers came out. And that was something that we discussed with John Derrick on Thursday about the dollar being at a tipping point, because the dollar's been actually really weak. And it had seen, as he mentioned, a 2 standard deviation to the downside. That has been a positive catalyst for the market, because even as the Fed has been raising interest rates, with the dollar falling, that's actually made financial conditions more loose. So if we do see the dollar start to rally, as we saw on Friday with the positive jobs report, this could be changing some important trends for the rest of this month. One would be that we might start to see financial conditions tighten up a little bit as the dollar gets stronger. If we see that trend, we might see more pressure now on commodities, on gold, since the dollar, of course, acts as a headwind on those areas. Some of the favorable things that we might see if the dollar were to strengthen from here is that, given the expectation that this is really predicated on further tightening by the Fed, well, in that case, interest rates will be moving up. This will be benefiting financials. This would also benefit the Russell 2000 index, the small cap sector, which is highly dominated by financials. European equities as well have also been underperforming. They've been under some pressure based on the strength in the euro. However, if we see that trend now reversing, where the dollar strengthening and the euro is moderating, then in that case, we might start to see better performance out of the European equity side of things. So really, the change that we now see in the dollar on Friday, if this were to persist, and this is a longer term trend, as we discussed on Thursday with John Derrick, then if that trend is going to persist, then we might be looking at a number of different market implications that will be taking place on the margins in terms of investment strategy that we're going to be looking at and keeping on our radar in the weeks ahead.
Let's then talk about earnings. About what, half of major companies have reported for the second quarter so far. What is the trend that you're seeing, Chris?
Yeah, John, this has actually been a pretty spectacular earnings season. And according to FactSet, more than 70% of S&P 500 companies have now beat expectations. This is the best showing since FactSet began tracking this data in 2008. One of the interesting things that we do see is the psychological reaction by investors to earnings announcements. And so there's actually a chart showing that the average one-day change for U.S. stocks after reporting their quarterly results has been quite negative. And so basically what's happening is we are seeing companies beat expectations, but investors have such high expectations that if they meet or just slightly miss, then in that case, investors are really punishing a lot of these stocks. And so that was an important signal that Peter Bukvar had mentioned on FS Insider when we spoke to him a couple weeks ago, given that we want to be looking at how investors are reacting to the second quarter corporate earnings announcements. And the key thing that he said is, if we start to see investors really punishing these stocks, if they don't perform well, then that's a sign that this shifting narrative from central banks providing liquidity and being a tailwind to the market now moving to a headwind by withdrawing liquidity as they raise interest rates, the Fed being the first one and then the ECB potentially being the second one, that's one thing that we're going to see with corporate earnings. And so investors really have now a high bar that they're setting with companies. And so even though we see such a high beat rate, investors are not rewarding companies that well. So that's a pretty good sign, and I think an important thing to keep on our radar. You know, once again, when we think about the economy, the jobs data that just came out this week was still positive, though bears are picking that apart a little bit and saying that most of the employment gains that we saw are concentrated primarily in food services. And if you read the actual data for the BLS, they say that employment in food services and drinking places rose by 53,000 in July. The industry has added 313,000 jobs over the year, but employment in other major industries, including construction, manufacturing, wholesale trade, retail trade, transportation, and a number of other industries, showed little change over the month. So overall, the numbers on the headline figures, whether or not we're looking at earnings, whether or not we're looking at jobs numbers, they're still pretty good. So the question is, under the hood, are we starting to see some deterioration? And I think, you know, from our vantage point, that's the big thing that we're looking for. And along those lines, you know, leading economic indicators are still still not flashing any warning signs. So we don't see any major trends to the primary trend of the market and the economy yet at this point. And I know that's something that Jim is going to be discussing more in depth in his big picture today, looking at a number of different leading economic indicators and the message that they're giving investors currently.
All right, Chris, anything else on the economic or market fronts that you'd like to sweep up here in your financial dragnet as we close out the week?
Yeah, so Fannie Mae actually reported this week that home prices nationally have now officially surpassed the 2006 peak that we saw during the housing bubble. So that's a pretty important thing. And I just spoke with Rick Sharga at 10X. That's the largest online marketplace for real estate in the world. And we wanted to get an update from him. That's going to be airing next week. But basically, he said, even though prices are higher on a nominal basis, that is for average home prices across the U.S., higher than they were in 2006, that doesn't mean that we're in another housing bubble. And so he made a number of really good points that I think is good for investors to be aware of, especially homeowners. And so essentially, he basically said you have to look at inflation adjusted prices, real prices, which have not surpassed the peak levels that we saw during the housing bubble. Also lending standards. And there's a number of different things that we went into there. But still, it's an interesting thing to look at the recovery in home prices that we have seen. You know, Fannie Mae is now calling it official that on average basis, we have surpassed those prices on a national basis. There is a lot of variation from region to region, whether or not you look at the coastal states, you know, especially the Bay Area, San Francisco, Portland, even if you look at Texas, Austin, San Diego, and then if you compare that to the Mideast, you know, there's a lot of variation there. So we're going to go into depth on that for next week. Also, a few other things on my radar is we're seeing strong investment flow still into emerging markets. Those remain robust. So a lot of money is still flowing into the emerging market space. In the Eurozone, if we look there, retail sales across the Eurozone are on the rise. So I would say general economic conditions in the Euro region are still pretty strong, whether or not we look at retail sales, whether or not we look at manufacturing numbers and the like. And then lastly, two news headlines that came out this week that caught my attention. This Friday on CNBC, Greenspan basically said that a bond bubble is about to break because of abnormally low interest rates. That's the headline from CNBC. And they write that former Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan issued a bold warning Friday that the bond market is on the cusp of a collapse that also will threaten stock prices. And essentially what he's saying is that there is irrational exuberance in the bond market when we think about the abnormally low interest rates. So he's making a fairly bold call there. However, he did throw in a caveat that, you know, there's no timeline to his forecast. So even though he's saying interest rates are at a historic all-time record low, they've never been as low as they've ever been. That being said, they could stay lower for a lot longer than people anticipate. But he says, you know, once they go up, that's going to be a problem for the bond market. And secondly, another interesting factoid that I wanted to share with a lot of you guys is apparently if you buy or own a home next to Trader Joe's, you have seen much more price appreciation than if you live next to a Whole Foods or many other grocery stores. So if you happen to have a Trader Joe's next to you, the statistics show that you have seen your house appreciate much more than the national average. So that was an interesting factoid for all of you to consider.
Well, that's interesting. And does that mean I'm supposed to pick up my house and move it somewhere where Trader Joe's is? You know, is it worth the transfer or sell where I am and go find a Trader Joe's?
Well, I guess if you live in an RV, you could just drive to a Trader Joe's and that might help. But yeah, it's going to be a little bit hard just to sell your house if you're not near a Trader Joe's and buy one nearby. And more than likely, that's already been priced in. But if you're near a Trader Joe's, then that's great. You've done well. And hopefully you'll continue to do well by the Trader Joe's effect.
Hey, we just got a Cracker Barrel here. Maybe it'll work if I do that, move there, you know, or something. I don't know. Anyway, Chris Sheridan, thanks for sitting in for Ryan Poplava this week. We'd better end it before this conversation becomes absurd, but thank you.
Thanks, John. Talk to you again.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
case you didn't know it, the Financial Sense NewsHour is more than just our weekend show. We also have a weekday program featuring key economic experts, which is only available to our premium members. Here's part of one of the interviews from this last week.
The market was braced for strong U.S. economic growth, higher interest rates, etc. We haven't really gotten that. And so we've seen the dollar trade lower through the course of the year. And it's getting to an extreme. We're almost down to standard deviation move. I basically did a rolling 7-month analysis, 7-month rate of change, basically year to date, to show the kind of the rate of change. And we're at that point now where we're pretty far gone on the dollar.
Well, it seems to be the same story just about every week. You look at stocks, stocks go up, another record. And it is another record for the Dow this week, with the Dow Jones Industrial Average crossing over the 22,000 mark for the first time in history. Will this continue? Joining us on the program from Oppenheimer is Ari Wald. And Ari, let's talk about the major averages. As I take a look at the Dow, it's in record territory. It's kind of hard to find anything that isn't in record territory these days.
That's right. It's been a very strong trend through the course of 2017. And not only has it been strong, there's really no warnings to suggest that we're due for a meaningful reversal lower. So it's very difficult for us to make a contrarian call here. I think what it's come down to is following the trend, that the action that we're seeing is very healthy in nature, and that the investor mindset should be that this is an intact bull market, and I want to be positioned appropriately. Specifically, I want to own pro-cyclical equities that tend to outperform in a rising market environment. From a timing perspective, it gets a little less clear, because the market is currently in what is usually its worst performing 2-month period. You know, specifically the months of August and September, the market is prone to see some sort of a correction, even if it's a correction in a bull market. From a timing perspective, those corrections often very difficult to time. We haven't seen anything of the like, really, or any kind of meaningful correction. When we talk about downside risk, for us, it's difficult to make the case of more than really just maybe a 3% pullback. So for the S&P 500, we do see a lot of support at around 2,400. That would line up with about that 3% peak to trough decline. More importantly for us, rather than timing it, we think that's your opportunity. So we're still buyers of pullbacks. And I think looking ahead, as seasonals then improve again come the fourth quarter, we want to be positioned for that. And looking ahead, we think we are set up for another one of those strong year-end rallies.
You know, Ari, just out of curiosity, why is it somewhere around August in September, we always see a weak period for the stock market and typically a very strong finish towards the end of the year, the Santa Claus rally? It seems to be a pattern that gets repeated over and over. I've often wondered why, from a fundamental point of view, of course, you're looking at it technically, why we see these corrective periods at that time. Is it because by the time you get to September, analysts are adjusting earnings or economic forecasts for the year? If a company was supposed to make a dollar, which is 25 cents a quarter, and they haven't been doing that, then they downgrade the stock as you get close to the finish line?
There is something to be said about that. In fact, if you were to look at the typical seasonal trajectory of earnings, you'll see that earnings too has that seasonal tendency to dip in the third quarter. So the performance was really just reflective that there is a seasonal tendency around earnings. And on top of that as well, it is a time of the year when a lot of money managers tend to go on vacation. Markets tend to be more lightly traded and more easily whipped around as well, where you could get some kind of more prone to these near-term fluctuations.
Now, you're talking about, in this kind of market, you're seeing an uptrend. Maybe we get a 3% correction. Also, towards the end of the year, usually in the fourth quarter, we see what I call the inflation trade, where you see oil do well. I think of energy stocks last year and OPEC. You see gold go up and commodities. Do you see that inflation trade taking place as we head in towards the end of the year?
We do. it. And again, that's the more important point is that I think while this is the time of year, you know, with seasonals, it's secondary confirmation. If this is the time of year, if you're expecting a pullback, this is now's the time to expect it. We're not expecting a pullback because market conditions are very healthy. You know, and then come fourth quarter, if you're expecting a rally, that's the time to expect it. We're expecting a rally because this, you know, how we see it, this is still very healthy bull market conditions. You know, for us, one important point is that the internal breadth of the market remains broadly based. For instance, on the New York Stock Exchange, over 60% of the exchange is trading in an uptrend, trading above their 200-day moving average. We ran the numbers on that, and typically when that's the case, average returns looking 6 to 12 months tend to be above average. So you do tend to see rallies led by many stocks are typically the rallies that continue. That's what we have right now. As far as the areas that we expect to do well in this environment, the general themes that we have been recommending is more risk over risk off. Some of the reflationary themes that we saw do well in the fourth quarter of last year, we expect to see that strength return. Less so on the commodity side, more so on the bank side. What's been very telling over the past few weeks is that the banks have held up very well. They've outperformed actually to a certain degree, despite a little bit of a downturn in interest rates. While it's been almost the opposite scenario for energy, while the price of oil has ticked higher, you haven't seen energy stocks respond to that upturn. So, you know, going off the market signals, we think the more attractive play is in the banking sector, really financial sector overall, that following that near parabolic move in the fourth quarter of last year, they've spent most of 2017 consolidating sideways. This is your time correction. You know, they've moved sideways while a lot of the moving averages have caught up to price. Now we think we're in a position where you can see that longer term strength resume and see a lot of those stocks rally out to new highs.
Now, well, let's talk about this year's number one leading sector, which is technology, and especially the FANG stocks, where you saw Amazon last week get to an all-time record high. And for a brief fleeting moment, Jeff Bezos was the world's wealthiest man. Didn't last long, 15 minutes, but nonetheless, we saw these stocks break out. Now they're pulling back. Is this a healthy corrective phase for technology stocks? And do you expect after this they would continue to lead the markets, or is something more serious happening here?
We see this as a healthy pullback, and we do expect them to lead the markets higher once again. That we think this is a secular story, that if we're in a secular bull market, technology really is a prime candidate to lead those gains, not only for the coming quarters, but maybe even the coming years. What's very telling is of how broad of a based a move it's been. It hasn't just been FANG stocks. It's been, along with the large cap names, it's been mid cap tech, it's been small cap tech, it's been across industries. So while they've run up a lot and now they're correcting, we think the risk is more sideways. We think they could be maybe where, similar to how the banks traded coming into the year, that after a very strong run, maybe this is the point where they correct sideways while some of the moving averages catch up the price. But ultimately, we expect tech to regain their leadership status looking out, you know, even into 2018. So we've been saying that there's room for both technology and financials in your portfolio. We think you can own both growth like tech as well as value like financials. While we're more cautious on some of the safety sectors, consumer staples, REITs, telecom, areas with more bond-like characteristics with higher dividend yields. In our work, these are the areas of the market that are breaking down a little bit more noticeably, especially in relative terms. Those would be the areas that we'd shy away from.
So as you look at this, let's talk about the inflation trade. I want to move on to a couple other markets. Let's talk about oil prices. You mentioned earlier, you know, we've seen oil almost get back up to $50 a barrel. It's had a nice run since late June. But the oil stocks, and you take a look at the ETF XLE, are having difficulty. What is that telling you about the inflation trade heading into the fall?
Well, for commodity prices in particular, for stocks exposed to commodity prices, that would be an area of the market that we'd be shying away from as well, and areas that we'd avoid. That in general, we think commodity prices are what we're calling this secular non-bull market. Essentially what that means is we think it's in a very large trading range. We've found historically when commodities are range bound like that, equities tend to do very well. That to answer the question, what type of environment is good for stock, high oil, low oil, really the answer is low and stable oil, and that's what we have. Good for if you're invested in equities, less so if you're invested in equities exposed to commodity prices and oil. Energy, it's an absolute versus relative story. In absolute terms, we think they could be carving out this space, finding that floor, but we don't think they're going to be market leadership, that they look much worse in relative terms versus the market. They've been underperforming throughout this cycle, more recently coming off their lowest relative levels in over a decade. So to us, this is the market telling us that there's still risk in this group. If we're wrong about our positive market outlook, you know, if we are at some sort of turning point lower, you know, it tends to be the weak get weaker. We think energy is that potential area that could lead us over. Now, of course, that's not the case that we're making, but from a risk reward, we think that's the area to stay away from.
Let's talk about treasuries next. We've been in sort of this narrow trading range with treasuries at the beginning of the year with the Fed announcing they were going to raise rates three times. There was expectations we'd be hitting maybe 2.75, 3% on the 10-year treasury yield. Instead, we've bounced around from 2.1 to 2.4 pretty much most of the year. What's your take on treasuries here?
From a longer-term perspective, we are not expecting a reversal of what's been a 30-year downtrend in interest rates. And I think a big reason why, despite expectations of tighter Fed policy, why you haven't seen the same response in interest rates, why they have moved lower through the course of the year, is that they've still been anchored by bond markets everywhere else in the world, that you're still dealing with zero to near zero interest rates in Europe and Asia. And until that changes, until you really get global growth accelerating across the board, it's difficult to make the case that rates in the U.S. are going to go significantly higher either. From a near-term basis, as they move lower, though, I think you are at a point where you can see interest rates, at least from a trading basis, make a move higher as some of those reflationary tailwinds come back to the market, with the 10-year treasury moving up to 2.65% resistance. And I think in that environment, a lot of the financial sector could do very well and see some of that outperformance come back to that group.
Let's talk about something that has broken out to new levels, an area that has not done well over the last couple of years, and that's been the international markets. If you're looking at the emerging market ETF or you're looking at the MSCI ETF, all of them are breaking out to new levels. In fact, one of them on the day that we're speaking.
That's right. As you bring up those ETFs, it's important to note that they're dollar denominated and that they've benefited by this weak dollar that we've seen through the course of the year. And, you know, and I think this unwinding of the dollar is very telling. If you remember, it was actually a strengthening dollar in 2014 based on divergent monetary policy, with the Fed hiking and the ECP going forth with their bond buying program that led to the premium being placed on the greenback, the big surge in the dollar, which ultimately led commodity prices in free fall. It caused credit to weaken, leadership to turn defensive, and internal breadth to narrow. Now you're seeing an unwinding of that and going the other way as participation begins to improve. It's been a very strong tailwind for these dollar-denominated ETFs with exposure to overseas equities. Our favorite of those is the emerging markets ETF, ticker EEM. Here's an ETF that more recently, over the past few weeks, has broken a 10-year downtrend. That's right. It's been making lower highs since 2007. It's broken that downtrend just through the course of the last month. We think that's a meaningful turn in trend, and we think emerging markets deserves a place in the portfolio. We think that's going to be one of the better performing areas of the market over the coming years after really a decade of underperforming, that's an area of the market that could start to perform better and outperform.
Let's go back to financials, which you think are holding up rather well. Typically, financial stocks, or at least some of the bets that have been on financials that haven't worked out, was the idea as the Fed began to raise interest rates, the yield curve would steepen. And as a result of a steepening yield curve, that would encourage credit and profits by the bank. Instead of steepening, it's done more flattening. Does that concern you in any way regarding banks?
It doesn't. And that's actually why we're a little bit more encouraged about it. It's that the fact that they've been able to hold up, that the market and the strong hands, you know, despite this flattening yield curve, the strong hands don't want to sell their financial shares when usually they would, which I think is very telling. I think that we're taking our signals from the market and the price behavior, and the price behavior is suggesting to us this resiliency amid what would be viewed as bearish information. This flattening yield curve, I think, is very telling, and I think it's the market signaling that this financial sector is poised for a breakout.
So as we go forward, we're entering into that period of time typically where you see softness in the market or a correction. The biggest corrections usually occur in August and September. I think back, Ari, to 2015 when we had the China scare. We had huge sell-offs in August, repeated in September. You expect if there is a pullback, maybe 3%, but less than 5%. And if that indeed does play out as you expect, where would you be positioning the best? In other words, where are the best opportunities for a fourth quarter run-up?
There's a few things there. First, I just want to bring up the differences between now and 2015, that while we had some significant volatility in 2015, you also had much different setups in the credit market, and the breadth of the market was much weaker, and the leadership. And right now, you don't see that. And that's a reason why we're only expecting a more minor 3% pullback in the market. I think the areas you want to be exposed to are more the pro-cyclical areas of the market. Financials, in particular, I think are poised for another strong fourth quarter. I still think you want to own technology. While not tactically attractive here, I think it's an area that continues to work for the long term. And maybe that's what it's about. Maybe I think it's just really comes down to selection and where you're positioned, because I don't see the risk of that broad-based sell-off where there's nowhere to hide but cash. And another reason to make that case is that, you know, how we see it, there's still below average recession risk until you get an inversion in the yield curve. We talked about the flattening yield curve, but historically, it's not until the yield curve inverts. That's been your more reliable recessionary indicator that's preceded every economic recession over the last 40 years. In fact, the direction and level of the yield curve resembles points where we saw back in 2005 and even in the mid-90s, periods where you saw continued bull market expansion. So at the very least, I think there's going to be areas that continue to do well. And in our work, it's the more pro-cyclical areas, financials, technology, industrials, parts of consumer discretionary, even the healthcare space as well, beginning to show some signs of turning up. That's how we recommend positioning portfolios.
All right. Well, listen, Ari, as we close, if our listeners like to follow your work, tell them how they could do so, please.
They can follow me on Twitter, at Ari Wald. Or please feel free to reach out to your local Oppenheimer representative.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.
If you're approaching retirement age or concerned about making plans for those retired years and having adequate income, you're going to want to hear our Lifetime Income series every Monday and Tuesday here at financialsense.com. Right now, here's a preview of this week's Lifetime Income program.
Joining me on the program as my special guest this week is Joel Fuhrman. He's the New York Times bestselling author of Eat to Live. We're here to talk about his new book, The End of Heart Disease. Doctor, before we get into your book, I wonder if you might explain why is it we see things like heart disease, cancer, and diabetes in Western society, where you're less likely to run into them in places like China, Africa, or even places like Japan, where these type of diseases are less prevalent?
Well, I have to say that heart disease is something we can easily win the war on. In other words, nobody has to have a heart attack or a stroke. People don't have to get demented. These are diseases related to nutritional ignorance. In fact, right now we have the higher heart attack rate in us and other countries that eat like us, that the difference between the heart attack rate in one country compared to another country eating differently, as you're mentioning, could be a hundredfold in difference. And there are populations around the world, like Catawba Island off the coast of Papua New Guinea, where they have no heart attacks and no heart disease, and their ancestries are recorded there in the thousands of people that live there. And the point that the question you asked is why? Well, we're eating processed foods. 55% of the American diet right now is processed foods, foods that never existed in nature, that never existed in human history before.
Well, one thing that has happened this year with the Fed raising interest rates, and instead of the dollar going up, the dollar has actually fallen. Gold prices are up, but not as much as they should be with a falling dollar. Joining us from Weldon On Live and the author of Gold Boot Camp is Greg Weldon. Greg, let's talk about the position of the dollar and also its relationship to gold, which has been a strong reverse correlation. I'd like to get your comments in terms of where gold is now in relation to the dollar and why it has not been stronger, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, there's actually been kind of a decorrelation, at least for a time period here, in terms of gold, in fact, falling at a time when the dollar fell. So that's interesting. Point number one, there was, you know, obviously a lot of suggestion that somebody's stepping on gold. It turns out maybe there was some speculative selling, so on and so forth. More recently, the relationship is kind of snapping back into place. I watch it from a variety of angles, one of which is the relationship between the dollar index and gold directly. In other words, the gold adjusted value of the dollar index, simple ratio spread. And that is breaking down in a very significant way here after lagging and kind of not confirming. Now, in terms of the dollar, the decline is for real because it's not just a dollar story. And it is a dollar story, but it's also a euro currency story. So it really kind of comes out of being a story of from both sides of the equation that would theoretically, you know, support the theme and the trade to be long euro and short the dollar index. You have very strong economies in Europe. I mean, the German economy is booming. I mean, employment's at a record high. Exports just posted a record high and then their second highest level ever. The IFO's at a new high. I mean, just look at any of the macro stats in Germany. It's a juggernaut right now. When you extrapolate that out to places where they import, you know, intermediate goods to finish, to export as their, you know, primary source of income, it's certainly pipelined into places like the Czech Republic and Poland that have produced very strong economic statistics. More recently, you've seen Spain and Portugal post very strong economic statistics. Numbers out of Portugal in terms of final demand that we haven't seen since the, you know, mid-2000s and really back to the 1990s. So the data is strong in Europe. They've benefited from the weak euro and from these negative low rates that are emergency rates that, based on what the economies are doing, shouldn't really be maintained. It's still a, you know, the fragility of the banking system is still an issue there, and there's still a sovereign debt issue. But right now, Europe is percolating economically with numbers the U.S. would die for. And at the same time, you know, they're talking about tapping out, you know, QE goes bye to bye eventually, potentially as soon as the end of this year. While the flip side of that is a Fed that's not going to meet their dot plot for the fourth year in a row, that was expected to be a 3.5 by now, and is still expecting at the high end 2.6 for next year when the Fed funds futures are saying there's only a 30% chance of two rate hikes between now and next year. So this is hurting the dollar. I mean, and bond yield spreads are moving accordingly. And what you're doing is erasing the European, particularly the German yield discount. And that is supportive to the dollar. I think in turn, that plays into commodities. You're seeing the base metals rally as well. And I think gold has underperformed and is about to play catch up. In gold, I'll just throw this too quick and don't want to make this answer too long. It already is. But in gold, you have a coiled market, triangled off the 2-year exponential moving average. You're above it now. It's turning up and you have the lowest volatility, long-term volatility, since 2006. And after the time when you bounced from that same volatility level that we're bouncing from now in 2006, that was when gold promptly went up 300% in 5 years. So, you know, there's a lot of excitement around gold, but 1295 and then 1337 being key levels that if you get through, there's not a heck of a lot of resistance overhead.
So I know you follow the work of the futures market, what the smart money, the commercials are doing, and then also what the non-commercials are doing. What is that telling you right now?
Well, you know, the speculators are still long. We talk about gold. The speculators are still long. I think in terms of the euro, first of all, I don't think it's a crowded trade. In terms of being short the German bond market, I don't think it's a crowded trade. So that's number one. Number two, in terms of gold, which you really want to keep an eye on, you had a big rise in open interest on short selling. People thought it was going to crack 1,200, it was going to get below 1,150 and had $1,000 in sight. The market got short, but it held, Jim, right where it had to, the day it had to. It was almost unbelievable. And if it hadn't held there, you knew it wasn't gonna. But if it held there, there was really a good chance that the downside in gold into the same period when the dollar was down was an anomaly. And that's the way we viewed it. Since then, you had a 60,000 contract decline in open interest in the last couple of weeks as the markets rallied. It's been short covered. So it's not a flood of new buying. There was a small amount of new buying by speculators. Commercials did kind of use the move to sell a little bit, but nothing significant in terms of their positions. And I think when you look at the gold mining stocks, that's another whole backup to this play. But right now, yeah, the specs are long, but far, 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 far from anywhere near what they were, you know, when this thing peaked, not only in 2011, but even, you know, in last year.
Let's talk in relation to gold. Let's talk about two other confirming factors. Usually when gold has a strong run, you also see a strong run in silver, and you also see it backed up by strong movements in the gold stocks. If gold was to take off in the way you think it may, would you expect, for example, to be confirmed by silver and also by a strong movement in the gold mining stocks?
You would certainly want it to be. The gold-silver ratio is actually up. It's kind of almost moved back towards its higher levels over the last, say, 5 to 10 years, really. But I think there's something to be said there in terms of looking at something like platinum, too. You know, the industrial side, you see the strength in global economies. You don't see the strength in the U.S. in terms of kind of any kind of industrial demand. So, you know, I kind of do have concerns about that, even as it applies to base metals. But having said that, of course, you want them to confirm. And I'm watching more right now platinum for that, because platinum has really underperformed. And look at the platinum gold spread. I mean, it's at minus 330. It's at levels where it's had a triple bottom before, and it has a triple bottom now. And platinum is just starting to show some signs of potentially breaking out here from pretty depressed levels. To break out on the weekly chart, you'd still have to go, you know, higher in platinum. But shorter term, the breakouts are kind of coming now. Palladium is almost $900. I mean, you know, within reach of, you know, multi-year highs here. So that's another thing in terms of watching platinum. Platinum's my confirming metal right now, more so than silver. Silver, you would expect to follow, but then, of course, you always got to pay attention to the specs and the moves. And, you know, right now, I think platinum may be a better opportunity because it's lower on a relative basis.
Greg, what about the competition that you get from the digital currencies like Bitcoin? Do you think that's had any impact on the gold markets?
I think it's had a definite impact on the gold market. And I don't think, you know, you could potentially explain the fact that gold and the dollar were both down at the same time as Bitcoin was doubling and tripling in price or whatever. So, yeah, you have to suggest that that is a real possibility and, in fact, you know, some level of probability. I'm not sure which side of the coin, pun intended, I come down on. I really don't. I don't know if you've heard some of the other well-known kind of pundits out there that, you know, in the research business, talking about, you know, Fed coin, and the Fed's going to ultimately move to this as a way to remove cash from society. And that's an interesting thought process. I mean, as opposed to the SEC now going after, you know, DAOs, where there was a recent ICO that the SEC said, basically enough, we have to put regulatory oversight onto this kind of thing. So is it going to be the boom that ends paper money, or is it going to be, you know, tulips? I'm not sure yet. I'm really not. I think it's such a netherworld product that not everyone understands yet to the degree that certainly if the Fed were to want to go in that direction, that kind of makes sense to me, as scary as that is, Jim. As much as it makes me cringe, as in much as it is an anathema to my, as a libertarian, you know, less government, you know, Statue of Liberty. That's, you know, the defining kind of word for me, liberty. That's a bad omen.
It's interesting because you have tech companies like Apple, you have Google, Apple getting into Apple Pay. And if you talk to a lot of millennials, they'll say, what the heck do I need cash for? I've got my phone.
It's extremely naive and short-sighted to think that way. It really is. It's so dangerous.
Yeah, I know. Because once you do that, then you have government complete control over your, not only your health, but also your financial affairs. Let's talk about two other commodities in their relation. You mentioned that the base metals have been doing fairly well, but you're looking for platinum to confirm that. A lot of that is based on global growth doing much better overseas compared to, let's say, the U.S. Let's talk about two other commodities, and I want to get to oil. You got the ags on fire, especially wheat, but oil has been struggling. It did well the first part of the year based on OPEC cuts, but that was only the first quarter, and then we went back right down into bear market territory. So what do you see when you look at oil?
Well, you know, just to backtrack real quickly, because we caught both of those moves. We caught the up move. We thought that just OPEC doing what they were doing would be enough to kind of, you know, throw this market the other way just because it had come down so far, so fast, technically ready for a counter trend rally. You got the stage set with a catalyst and boom, there you had it. We were looking for $55. And I mean, you came within like a dollar and a half of hitting that, depending on which contract you looked at. We then thought you were going to get a decline because the entire time we said, you know, Libya and Nigeria are the wild cards. Let alone that the U.S. is expected to go up to 600,000 or 700,000 barrels per day above year-ago level, you know, in terms of expanding output. You've had tremendous spending on infrastructure, despite the fact that prices were down. As soon as they kind of stabilized and got back above 40, you've cut costs so much, particularly in the Permian, that some of these companies have, you know, just vast amounts of undeveloped property. So that is always kind of now more of a bearish potential factor. But we thought that, you know, the holes in the whole OPEC deal, given that supplies were so huge, record, you know, so far above the top end of the 5-year range in terms of U.S. crude oil inventories, that it would be virtually impossible in any short time frame to bring them down. That turned out to be true, too. We thought you'd get below 40, and you didn't. So that was number one sign that, you know, hey, maybe this is a little stronger. And suddenly you've seen inventories in the U.S. plunge. I mean, they're down like 50 million barrels in the course of something like, I forget the exact numbers, but they're down like 11 out of 13 weeks or something like that, and 50 million barrels from the peak. They are now inside the top end of the 5-year range. The swaps the second quarter of next year have tightened towards a backwardation dynamic, which is a bullish sign, and gasoline inventories are low, and gasoline is showing some perkiness here. So I think maybe this is staging to kind of break what I would have seen as the pattern based on, you know, you're actually getting some declines in U.S. inventories, and we'll have to see how that plays out. It's a data-dependent market right now, and if you continue to see the kind of data you've had over the past few weeks, you know, this market may have some legs. I'm not saying, you know, you're going much above, gosh, if you got above 60, it'd be a gift, you know, 63, 64. But that could happen, and if it does, it probably takes a while, and it's probably choppy.
Yeah, the only thing I'm thinking of right now, you're still in the summer driving season. You got Saudi Arabia cutting back on exports to the U.S., which will help draw down those inventories. But Greg, starting in September, everybody's back to school, vacation time's over, summer driving season is over, and we get into what we call the shoulder months of the year, when you have nicer weather, when we're not burning as much fuel.
You know, I'll tell you, one of the other things I'll throw in here is we actually did a special report on this last week, just thinking with the dollar, you know, really now coming into what we expected it to do, you know, really since the end of February, that you would see a boost to some of the metal shares, particularly industrials, you know, look at something like Freeport, some of the really depressed ones, and the energy shares. And we did a special report on those two sectors specifically with ETFs and the individual shares. If your listeners want, be happy to share that report with them. But what I noted was that the energy shares, a lot of them are showing some really good technical patterns and some signs of momentum to the upside. And then when you extrapolate that out to which types of energy shares they are, they're linked to refineries or gasoline. So that's interesting. Phillips 66, Chevron, Valero, Tesoro, you know, those are stocks that look well positioned here. So there's also a little bit of backdrop that you haven't had over the past couple of months, which is, you know, the IYE falling to new lows, the frac falling to new lows. You now actually, I think, have some buoyancy in the energy shares and the ETFs there as well.
You know, typically, as we head into the late summer months, August and September, usually tends to be fallout in the stock market. And then as we get towards the middle of October and towards the end of the year, we have that strong run up in the market. But we typically also have a strong run up in commodities in the risk on trade. Would you expect to see that happen again? I guess that's the big question, because certainly on the inflation numbers, the inflation numbers have fallen far short of where the Fed has been projecting. And you have to wonder, with weak economic growth, even in the second quarter, it was only 2.6%. So nothing to scream about, that we would see that this year as we head into the latter part of the year.
Well, I think that really what you just said just kind of reflects the functionality of the dollar, really. So it is. I mean, the inflation has fallen. We knew it was going to fall. We knew it was going to peak in February. It's a year-over-year oil price dynamic for the most part. Grains have actually broken down. There was some hope earlier this year, but the numbers have been solid. I mean, there's still high demand for grains. So, you know, there's not the margin for error that some of the moves might suggest in grains. I think that's something that really makes a big difference to note. But at the same time, the crops are large enough to keep that market down on a year-over-year basis. Energy is, you know, even with this rally right here, is in a position where it will be down year-over-year still for a couple of months. So I think that keeps the dollar under pressure, which gives a bid, generally speaking, to kind of stuff. But I got to say, when you throw the stock market into the mix, you have growth expectations that are not been met. You have consumer borrowing that has kind of supported spending that's starting to show signs of retrenchment. Even in the most recent, you know, consumption expenditure data was really interesting. So I think it's funny to say this because in 2013, you had some risk extending from commodity price declines that started in 2011 in emerging markets that actually had the Fed not tightening because they were worried about emerging markets. Now you've kind of flip-flopped where the Fed is not tightening because the U.S. is kind of soft and emerging markets and Europe and Asia and, you know, even South America, you're talking about places like Brazil and look at the Indian numbers today and Korea, record exports, Thailand, record exports, even a place like Sweden, record exports, Brazil, huge trade surpluses. Relative to the U.S., I think it's the U.S. that's the risk now. And I think it's the risk of a stock market that is, if not overvalued, fully valued, and at the very least, technically extended to a degree that I haven't seen in a long time in any market. And then when you throw the technology sector in and the kind of the blue chip benchmark internet stocks, wow. I mean, some of the technical patterns there, in my mind, are almost unprecedented in how kind of toppy they look to me. So, you know, all this happiness around, and that's where you get a potential story in gold, frankly, you know, as opposed to a bigger commodity picture. Because if the U.S. kind of goes through that and you see a big decline in U.S. stocks, okay, you can forget about Germany, you can forget about Thailand, you can forget about Korea, emerging Asia or South America, because, you know, the U.S. will drive it. So the U.S. is the risk right now that could kind of change things quickly.
Well, you know, it was amazing because you mentioned some of these technology stocks, Amazon at 200 and almost 60 times earnings. And for a brief moment in time, Jeff Bezos was the wealthiest man in the world last week. I was looking at that and we sort of did a deep dive in our end. I was trying to think what portfolio manager would be buying Amazon, which barely has made a profit in its history, at 260 times earnings. And Greg, I took a look at it. The largest owners of all these stocks are all the index funds. This year, index investing will be up by 60% to $800 billion. They're projecting $1 trillion next year. And Greg, you know what index investing is like. It's mindless investing. You put $100 million in a NASDAQ index fund, they're going to put $13 million of that in Amazon. Doesn't matter what the price is.
Jim, I think that that is just kind of the tip of the iceberg, and that's well stated because that's true. I mean, I did a special report on this too just about a week ago, and it was the second one we've done in the last month on the tech stocks, on this exact thing. Here's the rub of the matter. Not only what you just said is true, it's tons of money. It's public through passive investment, you know, but it's also institutional. Institutional cash levels are low. Their allocation to stock is high. It's higher than it was in 2007. So the professional, the institutions are in, the public is back in. The level of nominal price in Amazon and Google, $1,000 a share, okay? You think about how many shares someone that bought it lower, sitting on a huge profit, they go to take these profits and try to sell the amount of shares they own at this price. Look at a chart of the volume of these stocks. It has collapsed because the nominal price is so high. So this is a real issue. That if you have institutions loaded, the passive is loaded, the public has actually just kind of even more recently just come in. Schwab, most brokerage accounts they've opened in 6 months in the first half of this year since 1989. You know, where do you think that money's going? Damn straight, it's going to Amazon, it's going to Google, it's going to Facebook, it's going to these stocks, Apple, Microsoft. Those are the five that we really watch here. The patterns are ominous and it's scary if everyone trying to get to the door at the same time. There's no volume. There'll be no buyers. It will be painful.
That's what I see, because I take a look at who owns all these stocks. They're all index funds. And if everybody starts to panic, as the public usually does when you get a bubble-like formation, as we're seeing in these stocks today, if they're all getting out of their index funds and the index funds all own it, who are they going to sell to?
There'll be no one there. And it's, you know, when it's such a high nominal price, even people that might buy it are not going to be buying as many shares as there's going to be on the offer. So you have, I mean, the imbalances here go beyond whether they're making money or not. this goes down to the kind of dynamics of logistics, of process. You know, I mean, the process could break down here in terms of, you know, when people go to sell, there's no buyers. Talk about a flash crash. You have the setup here perfectly for a flash crash.
I could see it coming. Well, listen, Greg, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow all the work that you do, how could they do so, please?
Sure. You can go to weldononline.com. That's WELDON online, one word, .com. Sign up for a free trial if you haven't had one before. We do this daily. We cover all the sectors, foreign exchange, fixed income, stock indexes and ETFs globally, precious, industrial metals, energy, and ags. We have specific trading strategies that we put in and track in our trade lab that is part of the Weldon Live. And we've done a couple of recent special reports. We actually just did one on gold. We just did one on the tech stocks and the overall stock market, transportations as well. Airlines look risky quite a bit here too. And look what we saw in auto sales yesterday. And also did one on the metals and energy shares and ETFs. So, you know, if you want to shoot me an email, I'd be happy to share those reports with you. I'm at Greg Weldon at WeldonOnline.com.
Well, things are getting a little bubbly out there, aren't they? I mean, for the United States, things are looking pretty good. Stock market hitting records. U.S. economy picked up in the second quarter, growing at about 2.6% annually. Unemployment, the lowest in decades. The wages are rising. Oil prices are stable. Gasoline is low. Inflation is falling. What a Goldilocks economy. When you look at it, the U.S. economy and stock market are in their ninth year of recovery. And now, to be a party pooper on the whole thing, how long can the good times last? And when it starts to unlast, what does it look like so you don't get burned as it goes down? We'll talk about that next as the main subject of the Big Picture as the Financial Sense News Hour continues at financialsense.com.